You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
It is a somber DMZ. You know, Matt and I, we tend to like to treat politics in as glib a fashion as possible. Much more difficult after what's happened over the past couple of days. But you,
well,
Matt,
how about the past year? How about this? I think you've said it's a somber DMZ more times this year than ever.
Probably. And it's something I always, you know, think about, even when you have a horrible event like Dallas where five officers died. You know, we had a bombing in Iraq where over 200 people died. We've had total devastation in Syria where hundreds of thousands have died. I mean, there's awfulness on a daily basis throughout all of history. And we can't live our entire lives in a somber way. But obviously this hits very close to home. And the
it
facts
does
are...
Feel, I mean, it does feel like, I mean, aside from the most recent news, I mean, it does feel like things are spinning out of control. And some of that maybe is just we're hearing more about things than we used to, and that's good and bad. But, you know, and some of it might be the media. Like, I mean, I think, like, it, you know, whether it's terrorist attacks, whether it is alligators killing children or gorillas being shot before they kill children, or the really depressing state of our 2016 presidential campaign, it seems like I'm not getting a lot of good news. And I don't know if it's because things are worse now than they have been in a long time, or if it's like the fact that that the media's changed, and that frankly that I'm compelled to follow the news cycle closer than maybe I did years ago.
Well, I think that you have media changes, you have social media changes, you have what society is willing to tolerate changing. You know, crime levels compared to 25 years ago are way down. The amount of, you know, global military conflict is way down. There's all sorts of you know, statistics in the aggregate say this is far from spinning out of control. You know, people comparing this to 1968, for example. I mean, this is 68's when you had Vietnam going on, you had Martin Luther King assassinated, you had Robert Kennedy assassinated. I mean, we've certainly gone through rougher times in our history. But you know, when you have the ability to have you know, online video
right,
capturing police brutality in a way that never happened before. It's not that there's increased police brutality. It's that what we're capturing what's going on in a way that makes it impossible to ignore.
And that's the scary part, Bill. I mean, that's the scary part is, oh, I mean, okay, on one hand, this is a negative. We are forced to grapple with horrific images, and that takes a toll on us. On the other hand, better to know about it than to overlook it. And I mean, how much of this stuff happened in the past that we didn't even know about before video? You know, I mean, it's really scary to think about how much bad stuff happened to people, including, you know, and Bill, here's an example. We were just talking about the OJ Made in America documentary, the right, 30 for 30 documentary. And of course, a big part of that documentary is the Rodney King beating. And that, of course, became a major media, you know, I don't know what the word is, but it obviously ended up, the acquittal of the police officers who beat him sparked the Los Angeles riots. And, you know, clearly that impacted the O.J. Simpson trial as well. But would Rodney King's beating have even been known had it not been captured on video? Like, I don't think so.
Well,
and now that everyone everyone has a smartphone. We are forced to grapple. And how many people, especially African Americans, but were abused, and like no, everyone just sort of reflexively trusted the police. And I do realize the context that I'm saying this in the wake of this, you know, horrific murder of five police officers in Dallas, which obviously we strongly condemn, but we still have this conversation, which I don't think that mitigates this other conversation we're having.
But so on one hand, I think Rodney King, you know, most people were offended and outraged by the Rodney King video, but those police officers were acquitted regardless.
Right.
I don't think that would happen today. You look at what's recently occurred, the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, there wasn't video, and reactions kind of fell along more predictable political and racial lines. But the shooting in South Carolina, where the cop shot, I forget the names involved, cop shot the African American person who was running in the back. There was very little polarization around that. You're not seeing a whole lot of polarization around what's happened in Baton Rouge, and St. Paul.
Well, I think the Michael Brown case turned out to be not a clear cut case. I mean, we know that the hands up, don't shoot thing did not apparently. Was bogus, did not happen. But I think, I mean, to me, I think the sort of encouraging thing here is I think that there are, I wrote a piece today at the Daily Caller about this, where I was brought up with the assumption that the police were, you just reflexively trusted the police. You take their word, and and the older I got, I actually began to experience before the video camera thing. I mean, just experience taught me that that not all police were good people, and that a lot of them. I mean, I've had some run-ins. Nothing, obviously, that compares with what we're talking about here. But just little things that happen to you in your life as you get older and you experience things inform your worldview. And I started to change my opinion. And now I think with the video evidence, I think that there are a lot of decent, good, white, sort of middle-class white Americans who reflexively believe the police, not because they're racist, but they just did. They believed the police, and for a variety of reasons. And I think, though, when forced to grapple with video evidence, it's going to be similar to what happened during the Civil Rights era, where you had TV cameras showing fire hoses being turned on blacks. I think you're going to see a lot of, kind of conservative white Americans who will not, abide by this and will not look the other way now that it is pretty much indisputable that this is a pervasive problem.
I mean, even the Donald Trump statement today was critical of what happened in Baton Rouge and St. Paul. If there's ever a guy who was going to stoke polarization on that score, it'd be him, and he has not done that.
At least not today. I'm going to give him 24 hours and see how he does.
Right. Fair enough.
Hopefully this will hold. have to amend this.
But, hopefully we can come out of all this with a sense, because I think people are kind of prone to say everything is awful. And I think that gives way too much credit to those who are being murderous here. We should be able to display that they are not representative of America by a long shot.
I'm looking really hard, to find something positive to come out of this, because it seems like everything's horrible. And I've been, a little depressed, a little demoralized by all the news, and this is just the latest. But I think there might be something. I do think you're right about this, Bill, that I think that public opinion is shifting, because I think a lot of us, were very naive, not sort of I mean, this was in good faith. I mean, you know, we sincerely believed that these incidents were incredibly rare, that they used to happen, but not anymore, that maybe they happened in the Deep South. And I think it's really hard to be intellectually honest and believe that now, in light of all of the incidents of this happening. And, you know, look, we still, and this is controversial to say, but, you know, this latest, you know, thing that happened, we have the Facebook Live. We don't know what the precipitating event, what precipitated this. But the video that we have seen looks incredibly damning toward the police officer. And you just can't, you know, maybe something else is going to come out that we don't know about, but you know, forced to confront, you know, what are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes kind of thing. I mean, it just, when you force people to confront things, maybe something good will come out of this in terms of public opinion, and then that will ultimately change public policy.
Well, and I think that, I mean, we're still very divided on gun control. You know, I mean, I don't necessarily assume that that problem is going to get solved in a consensus way anytime soon. Although with this election may well, I mean, we'll see if there is a Democratic sweep, then Hillary's running on gun control. If maybe that does, you know, move the needle, I'm not predicting that, but it's a possibility. My sense is that the average police chief doesn't want this. They don't want to be in a situation where they have to defend an unconscionable act by one of their officers. We definitely have examples of police cultures that are difficult to change, that are long-standing. You know, even when you install a more enlightened police chief, that's very difficult to change decades of prejudicial attitude. I think that's a case where, you know, the arc of history is going to be police chief saying, I gotta stamp this out. I do not want this on my record.
Yeah,
I don't want to.
And Bill, I mean, as you know, like, my dad was a prison guard. My father-in-law was a Parks police officer. So, I mean, I come from a background, and you know, and I grew up like watching Dirty Harry movies and all that, you know. I mean, like, so, you know, you come from a background that would see, you know, the police fairly, you know, pretty favorably. But, you know, I think that I started to see, like, you know, there's like essentially two types of people that become police officers, you know. There's the guy who really wants to like make a difference and protect people. And then there's a guy who sort of the jock who wants, you know, who like wants to drive fast and carry a gun. And you give that guy power, that guy gets power. His, like, you don't even have to be black. They're always going to take a cop's word over mine. And that's one thing that I do want to bring up is like, they can be jerks to everybody. I don't think that nothing that I've experienced, you know, compares to the stuff we're talking about. But I've seen it that, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And you give a guy, you know, it's a Stanford prison experiment, where people assume the role, you know, authoritarian role once they get power. So, I mean, it's a tough thing. And then you put these guys out there and give them an excuse to have a chip on their shoulder, because God knows there are bad actors out there. They deal with horrible people all the time who legitimately do bad things. And it's a really tough gig. And then I think compounding the problem is, who in their right mind today would become a police officer? Why would you sign up for that gig? And so my guess is you're gonna lower the quality of people who are deciding to become police officers. That could compound the problem. This is a mess right now. But the one thing I do think we could all agree on is the body cam. And that, I think, if I'm a police officer, if I'm a police officer with the right motives, I want that for my own protection.
Right.
And I think that, I mean, that's probably the only thing that we could all agree on that should be like a no-brainer to do right now.
Right. Well, let's move on to more traditional DMZ political topics. we had this. I would have thought, and call me chronically naive. I fully expected Hillary to not be indicted. You know, all the reporting leading up to this, if you paid close attention, was there was no indication of criminal intent. There was never really a sense of a strong case here. You know, maybe an underling for something or other, but I think close watchers were not assuming she was going to get indicted.
Right.
And so it was one unexpected that Comey kind of laid into her while not indicting her. So, you know, your gut reaction was, you know, that was the worst way to not get indicted, to have the chief of the FBI basically call you extremely careless with national security information. And then I'm doubly surprised that Republicans would take what I would have thought would be the best possible reasonable expectation politically Republicans could have expected from that scenario. I mean, if you're deluding yourself, you're going to be indicted, you'd be disappointed, but you shouldn't have been expecting that. But then take that and completely ruin it by attacking Comey, who has just an impeccable reputation. I mean, you have these people saying, oh, how could Donald Trump be so dumb to talk about his anti-Semitic tweeting in the wake of this? But this goes, and you know, Greg Sargent at the Washington Post had mentioned this, I believe others have. It's far from just Trump. Going after Comey is just total political malpractice here. And I can't believe that there's a complete lack of restraint across. I shouldn't be surprised, because overreaching has been par for the course when it comes to Republicans and Obama and Clinton scandals. But they were given a bit of a political gift here that they completely ruined.
Yes, well, it's an interesting point that Greg Sargent and others made, which is that Republicans shifted the narrative from being Comey versus Hillary to being Republicans versus Comey. But, so, you know, look, I think it's arguable, certainly, that this was a bad political, short-term political move. I mean, I think Donald Trump's political move of changing the subject from Hillary Clinton to Saddam Hussein and the Star of David was much more egregious. There is some good that came out of this Republican hearing of Comey, which is, I think, getting things on the record. So first of all, the law does not say that you have to have intentionally done this. It could also be grossly negligent. Gross negligence. And I believe that we have established that Hillary Clinton is guilty of that. So now the question is, just because you broke the law, does that, you know, other people might have been guilty of gross negligence and they would only actually indict you if they had proof that you intentionally did it, if they could prove intent. But why? Why aren't we enforcing the letter of the law? Hillary is guilty of breaking the law, as far as I can tell. And I think that was established. And I think they also established that she lied. And she lied not only to the American public, but under oath to Congress. And she lied when she said that she only used one phone. In fact, she used multiple devices. She lied when she said that she never sent any classified information. So Comey reiterated that.
Comey gave nuance to all of those things. I mean, you could have had the cheap shot talking point without bringing Comey back into it. What they did was, you know, they bring up, didn't Hillary lie to us? And Comey said, well, no, it's actually plausible that she didn't recognize these were classified because they weren't marked at the top.
Okay, there's another interesting point, though. He talked about how Hillary Clinton was not sophisticated in her understanding of what information was classified. This is the somebody who served for 4 years as the Secretary of State, and the FBI director says she probably just didn't, or possibly didn't understand the rules of classification, you know, whether things were classified. That is a pretty harsh, to use the term, indictment.
Well, but it's not nearly as harsh as calling her a liar who committed perjury.
Well, and that's the thing. That also could be considered obstruction of justice, lying under oath to Congress.
Comey is giving her cover there. You know, and so now, you know, Hillary has something to say. When you charge her now of perjury, they can cite Comey in defending themselves. Whereas if you didn't haul Comey back into it, you could have leveled that charge on her, and he wouldn't be there to referee it.
I mean, I think you're probably right. I mean, like, if this were a court of law, and if a judge was going to sit there and listen to the hearing, and not base it on like politics, but base it on evidence, then it was probably wise to, you know, depose or whatever they did to Comey. But in the court of public opinion, you know, I think you're probably right that you know, on the, you know, probably more harm than good came from that. But I still think that it's, you know, it's pretty amazing that the Democrats and that President Obama on the day, I mean, you've got the meeting with Attorney General Lynch that took place with Bill Clinton. She comes out and says, we're going to take the advice of whatever the FBI recommends. The FBI didn't even videotape their interview with Hillary Clinton. Comey wasn't even present during the interview of Hillary Clinton, and they didn't videotape it. I mean, this is just like, it's incredibly, it stinks. It looks really bad. And, you know, it gives the impression that this is like powerful people getting away with things that other people wouldn't get away with and covering up for it. Just, it really smells bad, all the stuff. And I think the fact that, like, we now know, I don't think it's really in question that Hillary Clinton lied to the American people on multiple occasions about this. And nobody seems that outraged. And she's probably going to be the next president. It's really quite amazing.
But you're still caught in, I mean, you've created the conservative narrative around this, where you take the worst possible interpretation of events and assert it as fact.
I didn't do that.
you're saying she lied.
Yes.
There is and you basically implied that the FBI and the Justice Department colluded to protect her.
No, I think I don't know about that part. I mean, that's, you know, that's conspiracy theory stuff. But it looks, I mean, I'm just saying, to the average American, this plays into the whole narrative that the game is fixed, that the system is rigged. For powerful people.
But do you think anybody believes that narrative outside of conservative people who already hate Hillary?
Well, I mean, look, if I'm like in charge of the Republican Party or the let's assume that there was a right-wing conspiracy that we could all agree on something. Mm-hmm. I think we would agree we're not going to talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that we know she lied and that the FBI director all but concedes the fact that she, you know, he really did admit that she lied. I mean, if you go back and look at the way the questioning, you know, like Chaffetz
said, the exact opposite in the congressional hearing.
Yes. Well, he would never say she lied, but it would be like, Director Comey, Hillary Clinton said that she had French fries for lunch. Is that true? And he would say, she had pizza for lunch.
Right.
You know, I mean,
he said that she said things that were not true. He didn't say she was intentionally lying. She's basically saying that she might have been mistaken about certain things. And I think even the question about the devices, I gotta say, I'm a little confused about this. From what I gather, you know, devices got replaced. So I don't think he was saying that she was using multiple devices simultaneously.
Okay. Well, that one doesn't. I think that one's. Yeah, and that one's less important. I mean, I think the fact that she, to me, the two big things were. She said that she never sent classified information. We know that's false.
There were three instances where there was the C marking on the email, and we know that the State Department claims that two of those markings were done in error. So I think even that is a bit murky.
I don't think it's murky, but we also know that there are thousands of emails that have not been recovered. That were destroyed by her legal team.
Well, they recovered some of those, right?
They recovered some of them. But they're there's still thousands that are missing.
They didn't find any smoking gun in what was recovered. He didn't charge that the deletions were done to cover things up. He explicitly said these were routine things. There's all sorts of stuff
but he also said that it's likely she was hacked by a foreign government and that using Gmail would have been safer.
That's an interesting point, because I don't know if you've seen, there's been some commentary around this. It hasn't been very dominant. And the New York Times had a piece that also referenced this. Comey said in his statement that... let me find the exact quote here. Said, while not the focus of our investigation, we also developed evidence that the security culture of the State Department in general, with respect to the use of unclassified email systems in particular, was generally lacking in the kind of care for classified information found elsewhere in the government. The Times noted in one of the follow-up pieces that one of the defenses that Clinton cannot utter is that her email would likely have been hacked if she had a state.gov account. So there's no safety here at all. Now it's obviously hard for her to say that, because then the question becomes, why didn't you do something about it? I'm not saying that is a totally exonerating point to make. But there's a deeper problem here. And I think there's a deep problem with dealing with sense information in a modern email era that's difficult to grapple with. So it doesn't necessarily speak to Hillary as an individual being deeply unserious and uncaring about national security secrets. It's also, as others have pointed out, it's not like she'd conduct all of her business on email. She does lots of stuff that's involving classified information that's not about email. There's no one has come up with a concrete in situation where here's the email that was handled sloppily and this bad thing happened to us as a country because of it. I think lacking that kind of smoking gun, it's hard to give the scandal the kind of legs that can make it really politically damaging. My sense is that that kind of activity on her part was not conducted on email. So that saves her in that respect.
We may have to agree to disagree about how significant. Do you think
she is in trouble now because of this, or do you think Republicans are more in trouble?
I think it's a wash. I mean, I think this is in a rational world, this should be disqualified. To make somebody who broke the rules as Secretary of State, jeopardized national security, lied to the American public, and lied under oath to Congress to reward that person and make them commander-in-chief seems insane in any world except where she's the only alternative to Donald Trump.
One last question to you on this before we move to a different topic. We might have talked about this in the past. I've written about it in the past. Whitewater, Solyndra, Fast and Furious, Monica Lewinsky, Travelgate, Filegate, even going back to Republican scandals, Iran-Contra, Abu Ghraib. These never work for the opposing political party prosecuting the scandal. It has never been a case where a presidential election was won when a scandal of regardless, you can say Iran-Contra is more serious than Filegate or whatever, but taking away all the value judgment of the merit of the individual scandal involved, It never actually pays off at the ballot box for the out party. So, and Republicans have desperately tried to take down Bill Clinton on these sorts of things, desperately tried to take down Barack Obama on these sort of things, always backfires. Why do it over and over again? Why not say, how can we beat Hillary Clinton on the issues and not on scandals that never... I mean, my underlying thesis on this is the public assumes that everyone's a scandal-ridden politician. I'm going to vote on who I think is going to help me in my day-to-day life. If you can't make an argument that you're going to do that and you're chasing scandal, you're telling me you don't have the faith in your actual policy positions to win on those grounds.
So I think that... I mean, I think you have a valid point that we overrate the impact of scandals, that we're looking for the silver bullet, you know, big Hail Mary pass rather than trying to focus on the blocking and tackling that actually wins the vast majority of games. And I suspect it's because of Watergate, that this is a holdover. In fact, Hillary Clinton, of course, was intimately involved in you know, the Watergate prosecution. And so I suspect that some of this just has to do with the fact that so many of our, I mean, we're still, like, literally still the person running for president was involved in Watergate. So we're still, like, that notion that scandals matter still haunts us. Having said that, I do think it's a little more complicated than you make it out to be. Although, I mean, I think you have a valid, I mean, it's certainly a valid point. You know, we overestimate them, and they don't usually amount to as much when you consider all the attention paid to them. But I would say two things. One, I think there's, you know, we always talk about we view politics through a kind of a cynical Machiavellian lens, but there's also principle involved. I mean, if you believe that someone there's a matter of justice and fairness, and if you believe that someone is legitimately doing something that violates the public trust, you know, you have a responsibility to bring light to that, whether it's smart politics or not. And I think that sometimes we underestimate, like, the altruistic or sincere parts of politicians. Like, the same reason that, like, we assume that the only reason people support the Second Amendment is because the NRA is giving them money. Like, that's not true. People, like, sincerely have a worldview, and that is pro Second Amendment, which is why the NRA gives them money. So I think some of this is not political calculation, is bad politics, but they actually do it because they think it's the right thing to do. Like, Bill Clinton did something inappropriate in the Oval Office. We need to prosecute, like, we need to bring this out. The public has a right to know, even though it all ends up hurting them. The other thing I would say is I do think that there's a matter of accretion. So Abu Ghraib might not have beaten George Bush in 2004, but he damn near lost. And ultimately, his reputation, there wasn't a, you know, if you take Abu Ghraib, and on top of that, you take Katrina, and, you know, you sort of start chipping it away at his administration. And I think it's within the, you know, I think it's fair to say that Abu Ghraib was, like, one piece of, you know, of the puzzle that ultimately led to, the chipping away of George W. Bush.
But
which
that's because the Iraq Barack War Obama. Went badly. If the Iraq War went well, people would, no one would care about Abu Ghraib. They'd say, hey, you gotta break a few eggs to make an omelet. At least we kick Saddam Hussein's ass.
But I mean, look, I'll just say with Abu Ghraib, we've gone full circle. I mean, Abu Ghraib, we know about it because there were pictures taken, because people had smartphones that they would have never had them in the past. And they took pictures of this. And so we had pictures of the mistreatment of detainees. I mean, like, you know, I know it's a departure from the current conversation, but again, it's just, you cannot like overestimate how camera, you know, everybody having, we've had cameras for a long time, but everybody like always having a camera with them at all times, just dramatically has changed things. And I do think Abu Ghraib, made a difference, but you know, not an immediate electoral difference.
So I got a few minutes left here, but I do want to talk about something on the Democratic side. There is talk of Bernie endorsing Hillary on Tuesday, and that it might not be contingent on what happens at the platform committee, which is meeting today, Friday, and tomorrow. Bernie has several amendments he's bringing there. The biggest one is opposing TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, outright. The Clinton delegates have been, even though Clinton says she opposed it, their argument has been, well, Obama's for it, and we should have something in the platform that is in opposition to the president. That's unfair to him. We should talk about diversity of views and that sort of thing. And Bernie's pushing against that point. And there's some talk that he'll bring it to the floor of the convention if he doesn't get his way at the platform committee this weekend. But if his endorsement's not contingent upon that, perhaps that platform floor fight, if it even materializes, doesn't have the same political risk and political intensity if his endorser was contingent upon it. So do you think that Bernie has played his hand well? He's won other things in the platform. He won Glass-Steagall, for example. He's won financial transaction tax. He's moved Hillary on his way on college affordability. She had a new version of her plan just this week. She may come out with a tweak to her health care plan and embrace public health insurance option more robustly. So does this mean Bernie's done good considering where he came from? Or is this a surrender, not winning on TPP, misplaying his hand, holding out too long and losing his leverage?
Well, I think he definitely held out too long. But all's well that ends well. And if you consider where Bernie came from, I mean, he's frankly a joke when he started, and where he ends, it's pretty impressive. So, you know, as long as he can't afford to hold out much longer. But if he does what we think he's going to do, I think it'll be fine for him. And it's impressive where he came from.
I generally am in that boat. It's interesting, though. He has put a lot of emphasis on TPP. I mean, I think there's always been a case of the Bernie campaign of setting a very high bar and not always meeting up to it. You know, campaign in New York and campaign in California, for example, setting up big expectations and falling short. Apparently, Bernie and Obama met last month, where Bernie told him, "I'm going to fight this," and Obama says, "I'm not going to allow you to rip on TPP in the platform." It sort of is this, you know, whose party is it? And so all the populist momentum that Bernie has brought into this race, if Obama is able to hold on to the delegates and still get Bernie's endorsement out of it, it does tell you where the center of gravity of the party still lies.
I think we're out of time. I just want to do a quick plug for my podcast, Matt Lewis and the News. This week I talked to Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Eric Metaxas, author of If You Can Keep It, and Sebastian Younger, who wrote a great book called Tribe. So check that out. I think this audience would...
Everyone should hear the previous podcast you did with John Ziegler about the state of conservative media and Trump. That was, I mean, you've gotten a lot of accolades for that. If you're a liberal and you don't like listen to Matt's stuff when I'm not around, you'll want to listen to this one. It is a Schadenfreude cornucopia.
Yeah, John Ziegler pulled no punches, and he speaks as a guy who is and was a conservative talk radio host who knows the game from the inside. Not a lot of podcasts are that revealing, so check it out.
All right, I got to jump. Matt, I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.